Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The University of Cincinnati's historic excavation of Troy began nearly a century ago. The three leaders of the expedition have their names emblazoned on the covers of books, but the dozens of local workers who picked away at the earth to find Troy's hidden treasures went largely unmentioned. In a new paper for the journal Bulletin of the History of Archaeology, University of Cincinnati Research Associate for the Department of Classics, Jeff Kramer, writes about one particular worker on the site and tackles the broader question of acknowledging the invisible hands of archaeology. He joins me in this recorded interview to talk about his findings. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Jeff, the name Blagan is probably very familiar to UC students and alumni because of the Blagan Library. Let's start with, who was archaeologist Carl Blagan, and tell us about his excavation of Troy.
Carl Blagan was already a rock star of archaeology even before he came to the University of Cincinnati. He worked in Greece, he lived in Greece, and he worked at a number of sites, especially on behalf of the American School of Classical Studies in Athens. Due to certain situations, William T. Semple, the head of our department, was able to hire him, which was a significant coup at the time, and basically continued to work on behalf of the department, excavating a number of sites. He'd already excavated sites with the Department of Classics financial backing, but the really first big site, the first big dig, didn't happen in Greece at all, but it was at the site at Troy. And it was somewhat of an accidental excavation because they hadn't planned on going there initially, but that's where they ended up for seven seasons.
Seven seasons. And so there were three leaders of the expedition, right? It was Carl Blagan, but he had two associates who were pretty important.
Right. While William T. Semple was the project director, Blagan was the field director because Blagan was the archaeologist. But two other individuals absolutely positively must be mentioned. That would be Marion Rawson, and she's a member of the very prominent Rawson family. In fact, her sister Dorothy also joined the expedition for all seven seasons. And then there was Jack Caskey, John L. Caskey, but of course everybody called him Jack. And he was a student of Blagan, so he actually started all of this as a graduate student. But in addition to excavating at Troy, he then went on to become the director of the American School in Athens, and eventually succeeded Blagan at the University of Cincinnati as the primary professor of Greek prehistory.
Oh. Now, the bulk of our conversation is really about these unacknowledged workers who did the actual digging at the site. What got you interested in them and their contributions?
As the archivist, I'm basically tasked with going through all of the records with Troy, and Troy is a remarkably complete collection. In addition to notebooks, which are typically kept. Everybody who excavates has to keep a notebook every day. There are also literally thousands of photographs. In fact, we've scanned over 9,300 of these. While going through those, scanning these, while going through the notebooks, I started seeing a number of references to workers, and I also saw, of course, photographs of them. But when I went back to the original publication, there was one sentence and one individual. And yet I knew from these other sources, including worker payrolls, that on more than one occasion, there were over 100 people working for the excavation who received absolutely zero acknowledgement.
Was that pretty typical for the time?
It was extremely typical. In the 20s and 30s, when you had this era of big digs, certain sites would employ dozens, scores, sometimes even hundreds of workers. If they were ever photographed, they were simply used as models, basically stand-ins for how tall something was, for example, or they were simply ignored entirely, even in the photographs. So this was something that was very typical. This was a very colonialist attitude, and unfortunately, it really kind of continued well in for another several decades, well into the 70s, 80s, even the 90s in some locations.
Yeah. Your paper focused on one of these workers in particular, I think the one that was named that you just mentioned, who played an especially important role during these seven seasons of excavation. Tell us about him.
So Connie Barron is a fascinating figure. In many regards, he's remarkable of all his life experiences. On the flip side, though, he is also very typical of all these individuals who were caught up in the current of regional and even global affairs in the early part of the 20th century. So when he was born, for example, he was born as in a village that was part of the Ottoman Empire. But of course, he left sometime before the Ottoman Empire and World War I broke out to come across the ocean, to come across the Atlantic, where he went to Canada at the age of probably 12 or so. And then from Canada, he actually came south and worked in, of all places, Akron, Ohio, where he worked in a rubber factory. During this time, of course, he's picking up all the languages of his coworkers, as well as English, obviously. And when he returns, his world is completely changed. And because of other events that take place, especially the war between Greece and Turkey, and because of the compulsory population exchange, anybody who was Muslim, regardless of where they were in Greece, was forced to move to Turkey. Anybody who was Christian in Turkey were considered Greek, and they were forced to move to Greece. This created enormous hardship on both sides. This is still a traumatic memory. A century later in Greece, this is still being discussed. And Connie was part of this. In fact, all of the workers really were who worked on Troy less than a decade before they started working at Troy had been refugees. They were simply dumped in a location, told this is now your homeland. This is where you're going to live. That's your house. Good luck.
Connie sounds like such a remarkable person. I mean, to have all these experiences, as you said, traveling across the ocean, living in Canada, living in Akron, this Ohio connection of all things.
Right.
Then going back home, being forced to relocate. I mean, all of the difficult things that he had to do. And then he was actually mentioned briefly by name by Carl Blagan. How unusual was that? And what do you think the fact that he was mentioned by name, what does that say about his role on the site?
It says that his role was extraordinarily important. He began as a simple laborer, but obviously because of his abilities, because he was very quick to learn, also the fact that he spoke English, whereas most of the archaeologists from Cincinnati, they spoke some Turkish, but not nearly as fluently as he spoke English. He was able to essentially move up the chain, becoming more and more indispensable. And I think the fact that he wasn't just an indispensable member of the team, but actually a friend is one of the reasons why he was specifically mentioned in Blagan's final report that was published in 1950.
He spoke English, but your paper mentions, and I think Carl Blagan mentions when he writes about Connie, that he spoke a lot of other languages too, didn't he?
He spoke at least seven, and I would not be surprised if that number were even higher. In fact, there is an anecdote that Blagan mentions that I don't mention in my paper, where Connie is asked to give a tour of the site during the off season for a group, and he's asked to give it in Russian. As he's giving this, there's somebody who's translating to the other individuals, and Connie quickly realizes what the language is and that he speaks it, but he was asked to give the language in Russian, so he does so. And at the end, the people thank him profusely in Russian, and he responds in Polish with the language they were speaking, and perfectly idiomatic, I could have given this to you in that language had you preferred it.
Wow, that's just so impressive. You mentioned all these photos. He's in a number of these photos too, right? Can you really see the role he played through this photographic evidence?
In fact, it's the photographic evidence that shows us how many roles he did play, the breadth of his abilities, and the fact that he had boundless energy, that he was all over the site. He not only did what he was asked to do, but he could even anticipate what needed to be done and simply take care of that. And it became very apparent to Blagan and the rest that they could rely on him to take care of something that needed to be done. They didn't have to stop what they were doing, intervene, try to find a solution. He would take care of it.
We're talking in this recorded interview about the so-called invisible workers who were so instrumental in the University of Cincinnati's excavation of Troy in the 1930s. So let's talk about all the different kinds of work he did do. You mentioned he was hired initially as a laborer. He ended up working kind of as an interpreter, but he really kind of rose through the ranks and did a lot of different things. Can you talk about that?
One of the first roles he had was actually mending pottery, because pottery is an essential part of archaeology. And putting all of these pieces together is something that takes extreme skill. So we know that in 1933 to 1934, he was doing that. In fact, we also know that he continued to do that, but then he started taking care of ensuring the laborers are where they needed to be. He also ensured that if there was a building project, that he hired the right individuals to make sure those the building was done correctly. Because there was a rail line used to move so much earth, he would make sure that that was working and operating as smoothly as it needs to be, putting the rails out at the beginning of the season, taking those up at the end of the season. He really was everywhere. It's difficult to determine what all he did simply because he seems to have done basically everything.
Yeah, really kind of a foreman role, right?
And that's exactly what his title was a foreman. But he seemed to do more than that because he wasn't just a foreman of the workers on the site. He was also making sure that the operations staff, the people that worked in the house and did the other things, were doing what they needed to be done and such. And of course, in his translator role, which he received no additional compensation for, he not only needed to determine what Blagan and the rest of the team wanted, that they said that they wanted, but what they didn't say that they also wanted.
Like any good underling.
Absolutely.
You're managing up and down.
Yes, you are.
Yes. How much did these workers typically make on these job sites?
That really depends, and it varies over time. And of course, most of our records are actually in Turkish lira, so it's difficult to determine the amount that they made at the time. But I do know that despite the fact that excavations are enormously expensive, despite the fact that this one was even more expensive, and of course, despite the fact that this was during the Great Depression, the team paid them more than a lot of other places did. A lot of other big digs, there would usually be strikes every once in a while for an increase in pay. To my knowledge, that did not occur at all at Troy, which meant that the individuals felt that they were being compensated fairly. And there would be bonuses, and there would be other forms of compensation. Because of the wind at Troy, the dust is extremely thick at times, which means one needs goggles. Once one group received goggles, everybody had to have goggles, which meant that they basically exhausted the supply of goggles in the entire region because every worker had to have his own special goggles. So there were other things that they did with the workers and such. That was more than just simply paying them.
Sure. You know, one of the things we've talked about how Connie was mentioned by name by Carl Blagan and in his work, but he also wrote specifically about Connie in a paper called Johnny, I think you said,
right,
or in a kind of a speech that he delivered. Talk about how Carl Blagan described Connie's life and their relationship. It sounds like they got pretty close. He seemed very interested in some of the hardships that Connie and his family had endured.
Right. In this address, which was to the Cincinnati Literary Club, which of course is still downtown, still exists, he gave this speech in the early 1950s. I think it was 1954 specifically. And of course, this was long after he had left Troy. One aspect of these talks was always something that was unexpected, something that was a little different, something that the club would not have heard from about in any other way. So by discussing Connie's life, and yes, his nickname was Johnny because of obviously the similar sound of the names, because he found this life of talking to Connie day after day, season after season, so fascinating, he realized that this needs to be discussed. This needs to be, to some extent, memorialized, but that it also really reflected the fact all these other workers. Yes, Connie was remarkable at the same point in time. Everybody else at the site went through these same hardships. And so then, of course, when the excavation ends, and of course, the war starts. But after the war, we know that Connie then was hired by a company, probably because he could speak and write English. And they did continue to exchange letters. I know that Blagan specifically and Connie exchanged letters. I don't know if Connie exchanged letters with any of the rest of the team. But surprisingly, despite this voluminous correspondence that we have both in Cincinnati and in Athens, where, again, Blagan lived for a number of years. None of those letters survive.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is very much a shame because I don't have Connie's voice that I could then share.
Mm-hmm.
I only have what Blagan wrote about him, what other individuals wrote about him in their notebooks and that sort of thing. It's always a reflection of Connie rather than what Connie himself had to say.
Yeah. You've talked about how you looked at these logs, these daily logs that these archaeologists kept. You've looked at thousands of photos. Talk about all the different sources and records that you really studied to get a better understanding of Connie's life and, by extension, the life of the many, many other workers whose contributions weren't really acknowledged on the site.
In the archives specifically, one of the most important sets of records, aside from the photographs and the excavation notebooks, were the excavation accounts. I can tell you exactly how much they spent on whatever item at whatever point in the season because they kept meticulous records, and those all survive. That's one reason why I could even determine how many workers worked at various months and various days. But beyond that, there were a number of sources, secondary sources, that I had to study to learn more about this time period. And that, of course, is where the great library at the Department of Classics comes in. But it really involved studying a lot of turn-of-the-century Greece, the entire region, turn-of-century Turkey, which, of course, is going through all these upheavals, especially when the Ottoman Empire collapses at the end of World War I, the new Republic of Turkey, Greece invades. It's really a fascinating time period. Trying to figure out where these individuals fit into that larger narrative did take a little bit of time. At the same point in time, because his life was described by Blagan, I was able to really pull everything together to provide all that evidence of this isn't an exaggeration. This is not a fanciful tale. This is what happened to this man. This is what happened to the other few hundred individuals who worked at this site.
Yeah. And it sounds like from your paper, there are a number of scholars, of researchers who have gotten really interested in these so-called invisible workers in recent years. What do you think it is that has made that such a focal point for people's study in recent years?
This explosion in this area, which is very recent, I think stems to some extent from the fact that even today, individuals, whether they be students or graduate students or simply volunteers, are occasionally ignored. And I think for those of us who were part of a very large team, and weren't necessarily ignored, but part of a very large team, we realize how much it takes to actually uncover a very large site. Even if we're digging in a small area, there's still a great deal of effort that takes. And so I think between that and also the idea that we realize exactly how colonial the attitude was and that we need to redress that, I think those two threads have led to this. And while most of the research is focused on British Mandate Palestine and Egypt, so basically that entire region in the 20s and the 30s especially, I'm trying to bring that over a little bit closer to the classical world where we've also had these big digs that now for over a century or a century and a quarter have not been studied. So Troy is really just the first step.
Do you think this spills over into other fields of study too? I'm thinking of, you know, classical art. There were so many masters who had apprentices that did a lot of work, didn't get a lot of credit. I mean, is there a history here that applies to lots of different fields of study?
Absolutely. In fact, art is a great example where we know very specifically Rubens, for example, would have his apprentices paint something and come and add a few brushstrokes and then sign his name. So I think that really is a part of a larger trend, and it's not just in, you know, those two, but several disciplines have this where the achievements of one really rest on the achievements of many.
Mm-hmm. And pottery, too. I mean, that's very relevant to
right.
The Troy excavation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In your paper, you call Connie an exemplar for humanizing the people by whose labor Troy was excavated. Talk a little bit more about why you think that's so important to really humanize those people and recognize them.
It's very easy to look at a list of workers and they simply become names. In fact, because some of their names were so similar, they were given numbers at Troy, which really is a dehumanizing tactic to begin with, simply calling for number 32 rather than asking for this individual. But they had to do it because there were people who had identical names in some cases. But still, those lists of names are simply just that. By looking at the photographs, you can see some of these individuals. In fact, there were some boys probably anywhere between 10 and 14 working on the excavation, working in the pottery shed very specifically. They had their own dreams. They had their own aspirations. They had what they wanted to do with their life. But at the time, that's what they could do with their lives. And obviously, you know, as they grew up, World War II was right there at the outset. So simply remembering that these individuals were actually individuals who had their own wide range of experiences. And while their lot may have been very difficult at first, they were obviously trying to improve it like anybody else.
Sure. Archaeology continues today, of course. And you kind of referenced this a little bit earlier, but do you think workers on modern-day sites are less invisible than Connie and his colleagues were? Do you think attitudes have changed when it comes to the people who do the digging and really recognizing their contributions?
It has absolutely changed. I think to some extent, a little bit in reaction to the study, which again is about a decade old, really, this entire area of study. But it's also part of just the general recognition of the fact that nobody could publish anything about what was found without people helping excavate that. So there are students, there are graduate students, but one aspect of the most successful digs is involvement of the local community. This is their cultural heritage. They have ideas about what should be done with it. And in some cases, they want to participate, which of course is excellent because they're digging up something that is really, to some extent, theirs. In some cases, it's on their land, so it is literally theirs. But I think that the attitudes have changed in a general sense. Are there still individuals who put their name on the book and forget to reference everybody else? That, of course, is going to continue. But that is far less common than it was a century ago.
Well, your work is absolutely fascinating, and I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Research Associate for the Department of Classics, Jeff Kramer. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you again for having me.
It's been great. Up next, helping aging family members downsize without conflict, when Cincinnati Edition continues.